evening, and welcome to They Came From the North, your weekly dose of subarctic, subcomic, semi-coherent, and pseudo-intellectual ranting and bad impressions from the world of film. I'm Andrew Forbes, your host for this evening, and with me, as almost always, are, from the land of everything Franco except James and fascism, Montreal, Quebec, Mr. Gabriel Girard.
Bonjour.
From a secret location buried deep in the rocky crags of Newfoundland's unforgiving wastes, Mr. John Mercer.
I can't talk, so find it where I am.
All right. And by his side, his girl Friday, Steve Power.
Might I have the pleasure of your name before I run you through?
I already told you. All right, well, for those of you who haven't listened to our program before, here's a little primer. Every week we rant, maybe drunkenly, maybe soberly, through a body of work of a particular filmmaker, touching on the goods, bads, and uglies as we see them. This week we will be dealing with the late, great Howard Hawks, a director who carved a broad swath through the studio system of early Hollywood with his own distinctive style, bringing a unique flavor of hard-boiled machismo and professionalism, as well as a fair dollop of feminine energy to his more than 40-year film career. Born in Goshen, Indiana in 1896 to a wealthy family, Hawks enjoyed all the advantages of a first-class upbringing. His spirit of adventure was encouraged, and he was given expensive toys with which to test its limits. Fast cars and airplanes were part of his adolescence and young adulthood, and his love of racing, both on land and in the air, found its way onto the screen more than once. Like contemporaries Marion C. Cooper and Raoul Walsh, Hawks has come to be known as a Hollywood risk-taker. His love of danger and excitement was evident in the violent and energetic action films he made over the course of his long career. But he was not merely a man's man's director. Hawks worked in a dizzying variety of genres, from westerns like Rio Bravo and gangster flicks like Scarface, which is the film that really put him into the big time, to war dramas and film noir such as the, I would say, indisputable classic, we may come to disagree on that, The Big Sleep. But it may well be comedies in which Hawks made his most lasting mark. He bypassed the more theatrical style of parlor comedies of manners and quippy punchline setups, bringing more of a body, bristling pace to his comedies, filling them with trademark overlapping dialogue and usually quite a breakneck pace. Films like Ball of Fire and His Girl Friday paired often exasperated male leads with unrelenting female sparring partners who gave as well as and often better than they got. We'd probably be overstating things to say that Hawks took a feminist approach to his characters, but within the socially acceptable boundaries of his time, he crafted female characters that stood toe-to-toe with their male counterparts and demanded the respect they deserved. So, without further ado, let us delve into the good, the bad, and the ugly of Howard Hawks. So we'll begin with the good. I am going to spin the wheel of, I don't know, not exactly fortune. Wheel of
spin
opinion.
Spin the wheel, make the deal.
And John, you just earned yourself number one spot.
Nice.
What's your good?
Scarface. And pardon my language for a second. Actually, you know, I don't give a shit. Fucking classic. One of a small handful of 30s crime epics that managed to avoid the Cagney and Edward G. Robinson.
The mugging that made me so absolutely insane whenever I try to watch a classic gangster movie.
Is this the end of
the show? If I mispronounce his name, Paul Mooney. Yeah, absolutely glorious as Tony Commande. And, like, unlike so many of his contemporaries, and even when you hold it up against Pacino's performance in the De Palma remake, Commande's larger than life, but he's not a cartoonish supervillain.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's dark, he's charismatic, and it's a real hell of a ride just watching him rush headlong into that violent end he so richly deserves.
I'm going with
the proper ending here.
Mm-hmm. Well, what really wowed me from Scarface was the beginning of the movie, just the way he appears, you know, just in shadow at first.
Mm-hmm.
Like the characters.
Yeah.
Like, he's too impressive to be approached at first. You know, we need to see He needs to be like this menacing presence.
Hawks does that a couple times in the movies. Actually, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre scene. You see all the shadows of the guys lined up against the brick wall, and they all put their hands up, and then just the machine gun trail.
You know, it's really interesting. One of the things about Scarface, I mean, it's the movie that kind of announced him in a lot of ways. It was a Howard Hughes production. I guess Howard Hughes had probably directed himself before he directed what was the big air epic?
Wings.
Not Wings. The other one. Anyway, but one of the things. I mean, Howard Hawks sort of, when you look over his body of work, one of the things that really, I guess I shouldn't say it's one of the things that announces itself, because it's the opposite of that. He doesn't go for really sort of in-your-face stylistic choices. He tends to keep things very on the level. He liked to shoot at eye level. I think he said, you know, that way it felt more like you were a participant in the film.
Hells and Angels.
And, yeah, there we go. But, I mean, Scarface is there are a number of, like, really sort of expressionist touches. And it kind of separates itself from the rest of his films, at least the ones that I've seen in that way.
I feel it still feels very organic in Scarface. It doesn't try to draw attention to itself.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's in comparison to his other films. It's not, he's not going Tim Burton, right? But... certainly, I guess maybe he was younger. I guess maybe he hadn't developed his own style yet, or he was just more willing to sort of go for a clever little visual touches.
I think, but more self-indulgent. You know?
But even in something...
But like Gabe said, it is organic.
Yeah.
And like, in Only Angels, in something like only, even in Only Angels at Wings, you have kind of that style coming back with the... The blinds.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's often there's that this noir style that's
and
also
I mean,
in
definitely
a movie.
I mean, you can't say The Big Sleep, you know, doesn't ooze atmosphere itself, right? Like he certainly brought that kind of thing back. It just seemed like it was something that was sort of pervasive throughout Scarface. The whole, the sequence with the assassination in the bowling alley, you know. Maybe it was a censors thing. I mean, cutting away, like you said, you know, dealing with silhouettes and things, and you know, shooting the last guy, it cuts to that last pin sort of wobbling and then falling. Maybe it was his way of sort of outwitting the censors, but it worked really well.
It had a heightened impact, I found too. You know, like it was kind of a it increased the drama because it left more to your imagination. You know, like you know what was happening.
It felt more violent.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, it felt like more of a graphic movie, even though it didn't show anything.
I mean, I find movies of that time, when you actually see someone got shot, it felt really phony, because they'd sort of, you know, grab their chest, and there would be no bullet hole, and
they'd
fall over. But
do the whole Captain Kirk stiff and open fire.
Exactly, right? But, yeah.
Oh, my God, maybe that's what's wrong with Bill Shatner. He loved 30s movies.
And one of the things that surprised me when I watched Scarface was I'd seen the remake first, and I kind of assumed the whole incestuous sister relationship was an invention, like a later one. But it definitely, it comes through.
Yeah, sure.
If anything, it's a little creepier in the 30s one, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember when the Hays Code came through, but Scarface may have sort of just skimmed in underneath it.
No. Howard Hughes was quoted as saying, damn the Hays Code. And I mean, Hughes was one of those guys that was, you know, ludicrously wealthy enough that he could just go back and keep pouring money at Hawks to just shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they forced him to put another ending into it, and basically that, you know, they're like, no, fuck that, let's, you know, put in the original one. I mean, I've seen the alternate ending. I'm sure we all have.
Is that it's been a while. Is that the one that he shot for the, you know, I guess either the censors or the more squeezed?
When he shot for the censors, the one that ends at the gallows.
Yeah.
Whereas the original end is the original suicide by cop scene in movies.
which is so much, so far superior.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just, it's one of those rare golden age Hollywood movies that I can just keep going back to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's, I'm not going to say there's very few of them, but actually, no, there are very few of them that I can just, you know, keep going back to and going back to and going back, and they just don't age.
Mm-hmm.
Scarface is one of those movies.
There's definitely something very modern in Scarface that I feel.
It never drags. It just got this constant propulsive energy. And probably Muni has a lot to do with that as well.
But even the quintessential Ox dialogue is there, too. They all talk at breakneck speed.
And actually, going back after watching the De Palma remake, it's hilarious how when you go back and they've got beer portrayed like cocaine. You know, the shot of the beer mug just overflowing. Suds going everywhere.
I'd say Hawk's only misstep was that he didn't have Paul Muni slumped behind a desk with a giant mug of beer and then just buried his face in the head.
No, just like laying his head down the desk and just taping the giant mug and just watching all the cascade over his face. Yeah. Like watching the tide come in on a beach.
All right, well, how about next we'll go with Gabe. Gabe, what's your good?
I had to go with a Ball of Fire.
Nice choice.
Yeah, I've seen what three of his romantic comedies, that is Girl Friday and Bringing Up Baby, and I'll say that Ball of Fire is definitely the best one of those three. Mm-hmm. It's a very, I feel it's often very forgotten. I mean, the basic plot sounds kind of boring, like, how can you make a good movie of encyclopedias being disturbed by a gangster's mall? But Ox totally managed to do it, and I mean, Gary Cooper is very, very effective cast against type as this professor who's doesn't know the world, and Barbara Stanwyck is also a revelation in this movie. She's just so full of life.
She's awesome.
She's really amazing. And she brings so much joy and energy to their drab lives. And I feel that, I mean, it's that rare movie that has the quality of being intelligent and funny and also touching, I find.
Mm-hmm. Well, it helps that I think Billy Wilder helped out on the script on that one.
Yeah, he's credited.
You can definitely feel it.
He's credited as a co-writer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much inventiveness, I find, in the script, especially at the end when the professors use their intellect to get rid of the gangsters with the gun. I found that really, really amazing, you know, just like turning the microscope to get the shaft of light and get the painting pop off on the head and stuff. There's just so many trends in the plots that all come together, and like the manic energy that Ox used to put in his comedies is very well used, and it's a bit toned down in this one because of the context. It's more bearable, I find.
I agree. I mean, I find, I love his Girl Friday. I don't love Bringing Up Baby. I find, you know, Monkey those can business. Be definitely overwhelming. And this one, you know, it's still got that kind of high concept, very contrived setup. But it also feels like the dialogue feels more crafted and less just like a constant, you know, thunderous tirade of dialogue that's just hitting you in the face constantly. It's still got that energy, but it feels more controlled.
And I feel that you get more of a link with the main characters, like than even in His Girl Friday. It's a really great movie, but it's more affecting. Ball of Fire is more affecting, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think the characters in Ball of Fire are a little more relatable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, for sure.
And I mean, know, one of the funny things, I mean, I find, I would say His Girl Friday, I mean, it feels a little, it certainly feels more grounded. But Ball of Fire, they're still kind of, you know, slightly cartoonish archetypes. But they're really, you know, like, most of them are really charming in a way that maybe some of the other characters in the other films aren't. I mean, Gary Cooper, I would never have, if I were casting the movie, I would never have thought of Gary Cooper in this role. But he really gets that kind of, like, boyish, coy, little, like, foot-shuffling, charming quality. But
at the same time, you see the contrast with, like, the other old professor was married and was talking about the flowers blooming or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? He isn't afraid to just take the girl in his arms and kiss her, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd say probably the only thing wrong with it is Cooper really should have been a good 15 years younger, at least, in it. But whatever.
Well, the age difference doesn't seem that big, I find, I think, between him and Stanwyck. And anyway, she's so amazing in the role that you can't imagine anyone not falling over for her, you know?
Yeah. I guess, you know, now that I think about it, you know, his character, he's supposed to have at least worked on this thing for a while, so he can't be too young. He's a man of letters, as they say.
Yeah, and I like that, like, he's trying to read up on about boxing before he faces the gangster.
Yeah.
there's so many great stuff in this movie. It's very, I don't understand why I've never heard of it before we decided to do Hawks.
It really deserves to take Bringing Up Baby's place as, like, the one of the great comedies, in my opinion. Yeah, okay, so, Steve, how about you? What's your good?
I'm torn between two. I've been trying to narrow it down for the better part of the weekend, and I want to say The Big Sleep because it's The Big Sleep, but ultimately I think I've got to go with El Dorado.
Nice.
I just, Wayne and Mitchum, I mean, you know, like, what else do you need? But it was,
and Khan.
And James Caan. We mustn't forget James Caan. But it was just, man, there's something about that movie, you know? I don't know if you want to call it, I know everybody says it's a remake of Rio Bravo, but, I mean, it doesn't really feel the same at all.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a couple of the characters and sort of uses them in a similar way, but, I don't know, it has a different pace, it has a different, you know, the James Caan feels like a totally different character and has a totally different relationship with the other characters than what's-his-face. Nelson.
Yeah, and I don't know, I found, like, Rio Bravo felt kind of breezy, you know, and whereas El Dorado feels like more, you know, as far as, especially with Wayne, you know, it was one of Wayne's kind of more straight-up westerns, I guess, you know, like, it felt like, you know, quintessential John Wayne western, you know, not, like, light and breezy or anything, you know, it had the action, it had, you know, and it was really well-staged action, and Wayne kind of, he had his persona down at that point, you know, like, he really had that haggard John Wayne persona down pat at this, you know?
You know, I probably enjoy El Dorado more than Rio Bravo, but at the same time, Rio Bravo is one of those movies that, like, it feels like there's more for me to appreciate in it than El Dorado. It's slower, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's why I prefer El Dorado.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I really like Andy Dickinson in Rio Bravo. I really like Walter Brennan. He's an acquired taste. Some
you know,
people don't.
I think
don't go
what
for
turns me from Rio Bravo, and I think why I chose El Dorado instead, is, well, I mean, you got Robert Mitchum versus Dean Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a Dean Martin fan.
I quite like Dean Martin. Well, I guess I'm talking about Rio Bravo, and we should be talking about El Dorado right now.
Yeah. So, because we're going to get back to Rio Bravo in a few minutes.
All right. Well, Robert Mitchum, Robert Mitchum is awesome. And his I guess his detox scene, if you want to call it that,
yeah.
is quite amazing. I guess, you know, El Dorado, it definitely moves, and I love Christopher George in it as that, you know, slightly faster maybe, or almost as fast gun. There are a couple of flaws with it, I find. Like, I feel like you don't have a character like Walter Brennan's. You have, what's his name, Bull in El Dorado? I forgot the actor's name. As sort of like an equivalent. But he never quite sort of takes the place of it. I don't feel like the female lead, Maudie, really does much to add to it. But I guess you also have a bit more of a villain.
And I think that, like, the villain is definitely a big part of it. And I just the action in the movie to me is just so much better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's so much more well staged. Like, you could tell that, I don't know if it was because of resources or just Hawks being more, having more time or being more comfortable with it or something. But, you know, it felt more assured all around to me than Rio Bravo did.
Well, and I mean, it also benefited from coming, you know, in the intervening years between the two, James Bond had come out.
Yeah.
And I think that probably sort of upped the action.
Isn't El Dorado like one of his last movies, too?
I think it might be his second one.
It's fairly late, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, guys, before we misstep dangerous territory, I'm not going to take any hate talk on McHugh. I'm really not. The Duke with an Uzi. Just think about that for a second.
Do I have to? I don't know. I love El Dorado again, but I do have to mention there is that now very painful flower pot on the head Chinaman ruse done by James Caan, which I'd like to think that he regrets. That was painful. That's right up there with the gold finger slap on the butt man talk. Yeah, like,
you had to bring that up, didn't you?
You're sorry. That's why you won his Oscar.
You're a sensitive boy, aren't you, Tommy?
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so there you go. That's mine. Rio Bravo.
Mm-hmm.
No, El Dorado.
El Dorado.
El Dorado.
Oh, oh.
Ooh.
Well, I'm going to...
Chili Palmer's going to slap you in the face for that one.
I guess, you know what, I was also sort of trying to decide between two different choices here. I think I'm going to go with Rio Bravo as my good.
Oh, well, there
you
go. Keep going.
Not as, you know, not to throw it right back in your face or anything. But
son of a bitch.
It's one of those movies that, I mean, it is much slower. You do have Ricky Nelson instead of James Caan.
Yeah.
But there's something just so, like, warm. It's one of those movies where John Wayne doesn't feel so much like he's, you know, posing as this big tough guy and everybody's just, like, terrified of him. He's got this, you get the sense that he's genuinely this professional badass, but he's also got this real sort of like fatherly warmth to him.
The relationship warmth is what, to me, like the warm side of John Wayne doesn't interest me at all. Cause I find the guy just doesn't have the chops to pull it off.
Really? Because I find he totally pulls it off.
Fun when he does the
father. The 6.5 foot tall punching machine is what interests you about John Wayne.
When he has that third of gold, he just loses me. To me, you know, Wayne is just...
It's not a heart of gold. It's just, you know, just...
He's... Well, I have to say I'd never seen a John Wayne picture before watching the... beginning to watch these for the podcast. And, like, in both Red River and in Rio Bravo, I was like, hey, this is not what I had imagined at all.
Yeah.
You know, I had, like, this false image of John Wayne in my mind.
People, you know...
It's as far as the eye can see.
I don't know.
1,000 head of beef.
People say John Wayne can't act, and I think Rio Bravo is Exhibit A in refuting that.
I don't think it's that Wayne couldn't act. That's a misnomer. And I mean, when I was younger, I would have said, yeah, Wayne sucks. He's a shitty actor. But Wayne can act, but Wayne, like so many of the other, like the classic Western actors, they got a wheelhouse. And when they leave that wheelhouse, they feel really awkward to me.
One of the things to me that I like about Rio Bravo is that he has this awkwardness, especially, you know, Angie Dickinson sort of like flirting with him and starting something up. And he's just kind of, you get the sense that he's like, you know, I'm old,
he's
fat,
uncomfortable.
And like,
he's actually uncomfortable.
But it actually works for the movie. Like he's supposed to be. And it's really funny. Like he's,
now I want to see a remake of Rio Bravo with Jeff Bridges in John Wayne. You could cast Michael Wincott as Stumpy.
But that's something that I found funny about a few of the male characters in his films is that they're, even despite all their macho bravura, they're kind of intimidated by the women.
Yeah.
You know, like you have the same thing in The Thing from Another World. And in Only Angels Have Wings, too.
I think Hawks just liked the sassy ladies.
It's true.
He liked a bit of sass.
He did. I have one more thing I want to bring up about Rio Bravo, which I feel like it's the part of the movie that most often gets criticism. And for me, it makes the movie. And that is, there's a scene when, you know, between threats and assaults against this prison, that you've got the three main characters, well, I guess four main characters holed up in this prison, keeping this guy under guard. And there's a scene where Dean Martin just and Ricky Nelson start singing together.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say, oh, you know, it was just, they had Dean Martin, they had Ricky Nelson, they just needed an excuse for a song.
Nah, it felt pretty.
To me, it feels like that's the moment where you see that, you know, these guys are comfortable together, you know, they're friends. They know that it's entirely possible within the next hour
they're gonna be
somebody's going to stick a shotgun through the window and blow their heads off. But they're just, you know, they're waiting, they're bored, and they're just taking a few minutes to sing together. And, you know, talking about that fatherly aspect of John Wayne throughout that scene, that's what I, you know, think about it. For that sort of quality of the character, he's just standing there smiling. He's just, you know, enjoying the break.
Yeah, but to me, that to him in that scene was kind of like a, oh shucks.
Yeah.
And that's just not John Wayne to me.
No, I love that.
I will say,
you gotta get over your image of John Wayne. Steve.
I don't dis. No, I mean it's just from the movies I've seen.
Why won't you let him spread his wings? He can fly if you'd only be the wind.
And I don't.
He can't fly on account of him being so fat.
I don't dislike Rio Bravo either. I actually really enjoy Rio Bravo. It's a great western, but I just, you know, to me, El Dorado is the superior of the two by far. Mm-hmm. And my final thought on Rio Bravo is, if you're going to get someone to play a drunk, Dean Martin is a damn good choice.
He, you know,
they just told Dean Martin it was a Western-themed casino.
I just love him, you know, like, dunking his head in some water and just, like, he's got that, like, eight-day stubble. And it's just like, yeah, that's probably just the first day of shooting. Yeah. All right, well,
he could have been Cannonball Run when I think he even had to use his real name because he was just so sloshed the entire production.
Hey, Dino. All right, well, moving on to our bad. Again, for those of you who may not know, bad doesn't necessarily mean an outright bad film, but it's a film that we either like or dislike, but sort of walks the middle ground, has some flaws, has some things going for it. So we'll start with John again. What's your bad for Howard Hawks?
Getting back on topic, Rio Bravo.
Oh,
snap!
And let's just, so everyone understands, there's a big part of me that absolutely loves Rio Bravo. Mm-hmm. It's one of those movies that I not only own, but I will also watch it if I stumble across it while channel surfing.
But you just got to shit on my birthday cake.
It's I really think it's one of Wayne's best, the best of his classic roles. And though admittedly, you know, I do say I prefer the Duke he stretched a little bit. You know, I'm a big fan of the Shootist.
Really?
Shootist is. Did you just say really, Steve?
Really? I thought
John and I will fight you.
I thought everybody hated that movie.
I love the Shootist.
The Shootist is awesome.
Hates that movie.
Your dad sucks.
He's a huge John.
Hey, you shut your face. One day you'll be splashing water in your face in the bathroom. When you stand up, you'll see Tom Power standing behind you.
Wait until, Steve, when we do the Don Siegel episode, do you know what my good will be?
Your Don Siegel good?
It will be the Shootist.
Really? Okay, fair enough. The little girl and... Oh.
But I like, it's one of Wayne's best classic roles. You got Dean Martin cruising on charisma and whiskey. Angie Dickinson is dropping gorgeous. You know, the Burnett gang are great villains. You got the ending where they're hawking dynamite around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think Bravo's, there's probably four close-ups in it. So the rest of it is like shot in CinemaScope explosions. Like you can see for hundreds of miles around when stuff explodes. I love the shots of it, but it's one of the finest examples of the classic pre-Sergio Leone Western.
Yes.
But it has one element that I just cannot stomach, and that's Stumpy.
You gotta hate on the Stump.
I fucking hate Stumpy.
You hate Stumpy, Walter, and you hate Walter Brennan.
Walter Brennan may hold the record for most Oscar wins by a male actor. In Rio Bravo, he's about as welcome as a kick in the fucking nuts. Okay, just the sound of his voice. Yuck, yuck. Makes me want to reach for the remote. And what's even worse, watch him in Red River, which is not as good a movie as Rio Bravo. He's a much better actor in it. So you watch him in Red River, and you imagine how much better Rio Bravo would have been without his Brennan's wide turn into Toontown.
I'm kind of wondering, like, how much of that is, you know, I'm not arguing with the fact that you hate his voice in it and his role, but I mean, did he sort of like create this character that was then adopted by, you know, every Looney Tunes cartoon? And
yes, yes, he did.
He may have.
Yeah, because I don't know. You know, I thought I was going to hate it.
He just pours water over the grounds. Yep. How do you like them? Imagine that's Michael Wincott. How do you like them apples? He'd be shooting the dynamite himself. Actually, no, he'd just be looking at it and then explode.
Stumpy? Yeah. Going over to the hotel for a few minutes.
Joe, well,
if you don't come back, me and Joe will have us a good cry.
Oh, mercy.
Stop, we won't get him in this episode.
Doesn't Stumpy kiss John Wayne on the head at one point and then run away?
Yes. Yes.
I love that.
He's one of the few people in John Wayne's film career to escape unscathed.
I love me the Stump. But I get it. I've heard it. It's like you know what? It's the Fran Drescher effect. Some people are going to make The Nanny a top-rated sitcom. Some people, like myself, are going to take a melon baller to their eye sockets. All right. Well, moving on. Gabe, what's your bad?
I chose Sergeant York. It's a very, very beautiful movie. It's very well made. Once again, Gary Cooper is really good in the main role. But it is so obviously and painfully propaganda that I can't get behind it 100%. It's like, oh, this bad guy gets a conversion, and now he's going to fight for his country. And like, oh, leave me alone, please.
It was based on a true story.
It actually
is. He's a war hero, Gabe.
Seriously, I can just like see the guys from the Ministry of the Army or whatever, like double checking the script, you know, and giving Fox notes.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's one of those, like, it's beautifully filmed. It's got some genuinely, like, fantastic scenes. But it is kind of like, isn't God in America great?
I like it because it's a passable World War One movie, and there are so few.
Oh,
yeah, fair enough.
It's like, if you put aside the fact that you can feel, like, the story grinding its wheels, and you're like, you can hear the people like the script doctors. It's a really great movie, but it pained me to see the propaganda get in. Like, I was really enjoying the movie, and then suddenly, oh, it turns to God, and then like.
I have to say, you know, there's another great Walter Brennan character in that, or a great Walter Brennan character, depending on your perspective. He's the preacher who converts him, isn't he?
Oh, he's good in that movie.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
Didn't he win an Oscar for that one?
I believe so.
And there's the whole thing, like, the moral quandary of, like, ooh, why am I fighting these people when I believe that you shall not kill? And then going on the Vista and reflecting and getting the message. I was like, barfing patriotism.
You have to kind of look at the history of when Sergeant York was released as well, though. War was brewing in Europe, and a lot of people in Hollywood in particular were trying to convince like the American public to get behind the war.
I mean, this is the era when every movie ended with buy war bonds.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. They were really trying to pull America into World War II at that point, and at the height of Sergeant York's release, you had Pearl Harbor.
But, you know, I've seen propaganda films. I've seen, like, Potemkin or Triumph of the Will, but those movies are very upfront, you know, about their propaganda.
Okay, just before we go any further, Gabe, keep in mind, you just criticized Sergeant York, but you were like, Triumph of the Will, thumbs up, let's be clear.
No, wait.
I'm not questioning your politics.
No, let me finish what I was saying.
I know.
It's like those movies are very clear about their goals. They're not hiding, you know?
Yeah.
The fact that they're propaganda, and like it's very clear. Like, but
I mean, Sergeant York, noble though it may be, it is a bit more insidious in the sense that.
Yeah. Like, I'm not comparing the ideas, I'm just comparing the movies themselves, you know,
yeah.
And what they're trying to achieve and what they're achieving. And Sergeant York is more, it's more insidious, and it's more like passing off the propaganda entertainment. Mm-hmm. And that's where I found it problematic.
Good save.
They came from the North in no way endorses the policies of the National Socialists in the 1930s and 40s.
Marxist-Leninists or any other corrupt...
The Nazis.
Sorry, I studied German
Knuckle
film
sandwich
history.
Marks.
I studied German film history, so I had to get it in there.
Touché, sales.
We'll get more into it during the Leni Riefenstahl episode.
Oh, God.
Tune in next week.
or when we discuss, what's his face, the guy who was in The Last Laugh, what was his name?
Oh, yeah, the actor. Last Laugh is a great movie.
Yeah, but that guy, he stayed in Germany and did, like, propaganda films for the Nazis.
Yeah.
Like, instead of going to America like all the smart people did, you know? like Fritz Lang, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Emil Jannings.
Emil Jannings. Here we go.
All right, Steve, what's your bad for Howard Hawks before we get further into Second World War history?
Yeah, you have to stop me.
And that's a topic I could talk about all night, so.
Let's stop digging the hole.
My bad, I'm going to go with what was originally my first choice for good, and I'm going to go with The Big Sleep. It's an awesome movie. It is entirely, you know, like, it is one of the representative crown jewels of the film noir genre, but it is so damn convoluted.
Yeah.
There are so many, like, players on the board. There's so much happens that's kind of addressed and then dismissed that by the end of the movie, you're just like, what the fuck is going on?
And you say it in Bill Cosby's voice like that? What the fuck? Theo, I don't understand this movie.
A lot of that was inherited from the novel.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that like somebody asked Chandler who killed the driver or something, and like Chandler himself was like, I don't know.
I don't know if it was if it was murder or suicide. Chandler didn't even know.
He was just like, oh yeah, I forgot about that little. Whatever.
But I mean, you get Bogart and Bacall are just like the chemistry they've got in that film, and I know that was the period, I think, where the two of them were actually hooking up in real life, I think, as well. So you could really see it on screen, you know, that they had a great chemistry together.
And that was right after To Have and Have Not as well.
Yeah. And Bogart...
That was the Put Your Lips Together and Blow.
Yeah. For like, all of the talk of all these, like, the classicist actors and stuff and how everybody was overly theatrical and stuff like that. But, I mean, you had two guys. You had Humphrey Bogart and you had... what's his face? On the waterfront. I'm having a brain fart. On the waterfront. Marlon Brando. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you had Bogart and you had Brando. And those guys, like, to me, like, seeing as much of a classic film as I've seen, pretty much everything that came after, like, all of the real, quote-unquote, actors owe a debt to Bogart and Brando.
Yeah.
You know, and Bogart in The Big Sleep, man. Well, I mean, The Big Sleep, Maltese Falcon, Treasure to Sierra Madre, Casablanca. The guy is...
The baddest ass.
He was the first real actor I've seen. You know, like going back through these movies, and you see...
That's still one of the few guys who could wear a fedora.
You know, he could get away with it. But, I mean, you see Casablanca, and you see The Big Sleep, and you really see, you know, Bogart is attempting to bring method into it. You know, he is playing a character. He's not just Humphrey Bogart, you know?
Well, he's playing a character, but also without all of the sort of pretension of... You know, I gotta live in character.
Exactly.
I can only drink lime juice because my character would only drink lime
juice. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there are so few guys, even today, there are so few guys who can pull that off, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just, The Big Sleep for me was one of the best. I mean, his Marlowe is classic, and it's classic for a reason, you know? That, like, he totally runs with that movie.
Speaking of, you know, actors having a misplaced.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
Speaking of actors having, like, an unfair reputation, I kind of feel that, you know, a lot of people who maybe haven't actually seen a lot of Bogart, but they think they have.
Oh, man.
There's a sense, you know, they think that he only ever played the same character, but it's just because, you know, he was so distinctive.
Yep.
You know, you can't help but see Bogart, but he was always playing someone totally different.
And I love, too, like, how pop culture in the 70s and 80s kind of turned Humphrey Bogart into James Cagney. It turned into that, you know, but he was and still is, you know, one of the greats. He's one of the big ones, you know.
Yeah. The Roaring Twenties.
Yeah.
Amazing movie, amazing performance.
Petrified first.
Cagney and Bogart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Petrified first, man. Amazing flick. Amazing.
But I agree. I mean, The Big Sleep, it's one of those movies where it's like, I kind of watch it and I'm just like, I kind of just have to turn my brain off.
You really do, because otherwise your brain starts
to... awesomeness.
You, like, when you try to start piecing together what's going on, and, oh, maybe it's this, or maybe it's that, and your brain just says, no.
Yeah.
No. I want to go back and watch Key Largo again.
But, like, at the same time, I feel that confusion is part of what makes the story, you know?
Yeah.
If he wasn't lost, it wouldn't work the same way.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't come together is my problem. You know, like, the noirs, they always kind of, either it came together and you got a really satisfying, you know, final act where all the chips fall into place and stuff, and not satisfying in terms of, you know, happy endings, but at least narratively satisfying. Mm-hmm. But with The Big Sleep, I feel that there's... The final act leaves things unresolved, and that just nags at me, you know?
Mm. I think now's probably a good time to give a shout-out to Lee Brackett, who worked with Hawks a number of times. She wrote the screenplay for Rio Bravo. She wrote the screenplay for The Big Sleep with Faulkner. She wrote the screenplay for El Dorado, for Hatari, for Rio Lobo. She also worked on the screenplay for The Empire Strikes Back.
She did, yep.
And she doesn't get... I mean, you know, among people who actually pay attention to studio-era screenwriters, she probably gets a bit of respect, but, you know, she was a major force and probably one of the big reasons that some of Hawks' movies worked as well as they did.
And to have a woman screenwriter at the time was pretty much unheard of, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a rarity, for sure.
Yeah. Yay, Lee Brackett. That was my tangent.
So yeah, there you go, my bad. The Big Sleep, right. Which, it's not up on Blu-ray, is it?
Not yet.
It should be. And it never really got a lot of respect on DVD, either.
I don't think so. Well, I mean, it was one of the... I think it got one of those early releases, and so it was always around, but it kind of felt like just because it was released so early... I don't think it ever got really, like, a deluxe treatment.
It was
one of those
flippers. It was like a flipper. So it had two versions of it.
It had, like, the British cut on one side and the American cut on the other.
Yeah, yeah.
So Sergeant Jerk would look... fucking beautiful in Blu-ray.
Yeah.
It would be amazing.
I'd love to see The Big Sleep on Blu-ray. I'd love to see that movie given a good restoration and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to move on to my bad, which is leaning more to the bad side of bad, Hatari.
Yes. Yes. Damn the baby elephant walk.
Okay, Hatari is one of those movies that really tries to get by entirely on charm and scenery.
I don't think Hawks showed up for Hatari. I think he just kind of... Here's what the movie's about. Actors go crazy.
I don't think that's quite fair. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, Hatari, it's this sort of, like, amorphous blob of a movie that's basically just, you know, these guys, they get animals for zoos, and then a female photographer shows up, and they're like, oh my god, there's a lady in our group. Crazy antics. And basically, it's just, you know, like, 180 minutes of comedic romantic tension and, you know, footage of them going out and capturing animals.
Somebody needs more saltpeter in their mashed potatoes.
Well, Steve made a comment that reminded me of a question I had, actually, Andrew. He said that Ox didn't show up, and I was looking at his filmography, and there's a few movies where he was uncredited as a director, mm-hmm. like The Outlaw and The Thing from Another World. So I'm like, maybe someone else directed that Hatari too. I don't know.
But the thing with The Thing from Another World is, you know, he wasn't credited, but you really want to try to tell me that Christian Nyby directed that and not Howard Hawks?
No, it's so obviously Hawks.
Yeah.
And, but, like, for...
I still
for the
every time I see Marshall Dillon, The Thing.
Yeah.
And The Outlaw is probably used as one thing to credit anyone but himself.
Mm-hmm.
But was that a common practice to have people not credited at the time?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think...
It was the days before
The Thing
DGA,
from Another World
so.
Was... My understanding was The Thing from Another World was... Christian Nyby, I think, was like an editor or something, and he's sort of like trying to like give him a bit of a leg up, maybe. But, yeah, that obviously went somewhere. But, yeah, I mean, Hatari, like I said, I don't think it's fair to say he didn't show up, but, I mean, it was basically, like, one of those, like, vacation movies, like...
Like a good year.
John Huston wanting to go to shoot an elephant, right? But, except the African Queen is amazing. But, but it really was, like, a scenery movie. And there's some amazing footage, especially there's a scene where they're trying to capture a rhino, and the rhino is just, like, going at their Jeep, and it's, like, crazy to watch. But there's just no plot. There's nothing driving it, and it just... you never feel any drama. There's no tension. There's nothing. It's just kind of like, yeah, here we are. Let's wait around for a bit, and then maybe there'll be some more kind of cool stuff. Maybe. Then elephants running around. Baby elephants. John, I don't care what you say. They're fucking cute.
No, he's talking about the song, I think.
Yeah, well, I love that, too. Sorry.
That's what was playing in my head when I brought back that VHS to Alan's video. Really disappointed because the cover had John Wayne clutching an elephant gun.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
John I was looking at it, oh, man, he just raped the wrong school, man.
John Wayne and Baby Elephant Walk really do not belong in the same together.
No.
But, yeah. Atari, watch out. It's kind of like one of those scenery Blu-rays that you just put on during a party. Not that I do that.
So,
because that
it's like AFRICON PS3.
So is it... I was going to say it's like The Tourist, but in the 30s.
Yeah. Well, the 60s.
Whatever.
Same thing. All right, well, now is probably a good time. Well, it's the only time, unfortunately, to move on to sometimes the most entertaining, but also the most soul-draining period of the podcast.
And that is even a colossus like Hawks has them?
What's that?
Even a colossus like Hawks has them?
Oh, does he ever.
Oh, land of the pharaohs. Yeah. now is time for the ugly. Fans of Redline 7000, now is your time to switch up.
It's the time to receive the
speed
mail.
So I'm going to keep our order going, starting with John. Enlighten us.
Now, this is going to surprise a lot of people because everyone thinks I love musicals.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, my rich DVD collection, including Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and Paint Your Wagon and such other holiday, you know, all sorts of Irving Berlin pictures. There is not enough hatred in the world today to fill the flask I have in my soul for A Song Is Born.
Mm.
Not this
I'm
movie
really
is not.
Glad you didn't say gentlemen prefer blondes. I'm just going to put that out there.
Oh, because at least Hawks came to work on Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Yeah,
A Song Is Born is like not only one of those infamous golden age of Hollywood bombs, you know, dragged down by behind the scenes shenanigans. It's just a goddamn awful movie to boot. You know, okay, you got Danny Kaye, who was uninterested, you know, due to the messy separation from his wife, who was coincidentally his primary songwriter, and, you know, seeing he'd fucked around behind her back, she was very uninterested in writing songs for him. So you get a Danny Kaye movie where he doesn't sing. Mm. Oh, sorry, a Danny Kaye musical. He doesn't sing. Okay. Hawks was uninterested. I think the only thing Hawks was interested in was the $250,000 he got to. Maybe he was sitting backwards in his chair like the cool kids at school facing the other direction.
But I don't even think he was that interested in that because wasn't he was like he was getting well paid, plus he was from a rich family, so doubly uninterested.
The entire movie is it's less Hollywood magic and more like a group of folks who just can't stand each other and are just riding out the clock on cashing a paycheck. It's garish, it's gaudy. The movie's so fucking sweet that it's been linked to adult onset diabetes. It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible.
But it's got Benny Goodman in one of his few acting roles.
Copy the DVD I have right here. We're going to make this up because I don't actually have a copy of this DVD here, but I'll put it in your mouth and punch it.
Oh,
It'd be like the end of The Rock.
Are you going to tell him he's The Rock?
Spitting up musical, watching your flesh bubble away.
To be fair, I was being entirely facetious with all my defenses.
Yeah, it's, it can't be defended.
No. I'm not exactly a Danny Kaye fan to begin with.
Not even Tap Dances with Fred Astaire?
Nah. He's just not my cup of tea.
Okay, there we go. We're talked earlier about, you know, the people think that, you know, John Wayne only had the one character, or even worse, the idiots out there who think that Humphrey Bogart only had the one character.
Yeah.
Now we're talking about Danny Kaye.
I hate White Christmas. Oh, did I just say that out loud?
I love Holiday Inn. The, like, innocent, casual racism. Nothing warms
what's wrong
the
with
cockles,
that?
Nothing warms the cockles of my heart at Christmas like Abraham. And any listener who doesn't know what I'm talking about, just go on YouTube and search Irving Berlin Abraham.
Yeah. I can't speak too much on this because before we started recording, I was reading Thunder, King of the Congo. And that's not exactly, you know, a shining example of egalitarian fictions. What's that?
Was he the Marvel character that rides the saber-toothed tiger?
He's the Frazetta guy who crashed his plane in the jungle and... I can't remember if he actually rides a saber-toothed tiger, but he appears with a saber-toothed tiger.
Anyway.
We are so on track. Let's get back with the Michael Wincott quotes. Yeah, a song is born.
We don't even need to talk about it anymore. Just move on. Okay?
A vendetta is born. All right. I'll put you out of your misery. Gabe, what's your ugly...
Well, get ready for some hate mail, because I'm going with bringing up baby.
Yes. You are a national hero.
This movie is so annoying.
It's awful.
Everybody
you
moves
as... You're just a trillion douche.
Everybody moves as if they've just done some cocaine with like Tony in the remake of Scarface, and like they're running wild, buzzed up on cocaine,
or drank some lager with Tony in the original Scarface,
or drank like 6 Red Bulls in a row or something, and like the incidents just keep piling up. It never stops for a breath. It's just like.
And I hate every character other than Cary Grant in this.
You can't hate Cary Grant.
No,
you just can't.
He's unhateable. I think if it wasn't Cary Grant, I would. But it's Cary Grant, so I have to love him. But every other actor and slash character in this film, I hated. I should just put this out there so we're not doubling up. I also chose Bringing Up Baby as my ugly. I don't want to steal your thunder, though, Gabe. So
please. No,
it's tag team.
I don't even know what else to say. It's a mess.
The performances are universally awful. It is a never-ending parade of mugging for the camera in the most extreme circumstance. And I say this as someone who loves arsenic and old lace. Like
the most ridiculous pratfalls.
The most ridiculous, like, juvenile sexual double entendres,
pretend. Oh, come on, pretend that you're like a hunter or something. Like
there's, I don't know. I think there's like 2 points in the film where I actually laughed. One was Katharine Hepburn, something about breaking a heel and saying I was born on the side of a hill. I don't know why. Kind of laughed at that, and then
because it was Katharine Hepburn saying it,
I guess, and then Cary Grant saying, "No, I just suddenly turned gay." which just came out of nowhere.
I was, and I was going to bring that.
I know it's really corny, but the ending where they destroyed that dinosaur,
I wanted to wreck.
I don't know. Probably I was. My mind was numb by all the the rest of the movie before. So I was just forced into laughing because I was probably just tired. I felt like as a
you sure it wasn't like
the marathon or something watching the movie.
You sure it wasn't like the sad end of the world laughing from like in the mouth of madness, where you start laughing maniacally and then you start to cry while you're doing it.
Yes. As the tentacles of the old gods come through the clouds,
punch their way through reality.
And like we mentioned before, we like It's Girl Friday. We don't mind manic energy when it's well used.
No, I mean His Girl Friday is great. I mean, significant chunks of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and I was a male war bride has plenty of incidents and like ridiculous things, but it's really funny.
Is it really?
I quite enjoyed it.
Okay, well, move along.
Significantly more than Bringing Up Baby.
You guys don't know what's coming next week, but you're not going to survive it.
But I mean, even Monkey Business has a number of really good parts, despite having like a similar energy. But I mean, Bringing Up Baby, you know, Gabe, you mentioned earlier when we were discussing it, like it's the perfect example of an idiot plot. Like,
yeah.
It's just, everything is so forced, and you can just tell it just reeks of desperation to get a laugh. It's like, the worst Borscht Belt comic bombing with just sweat pouring off him onto his polyester. Like, that's what it feels like in movie form.
I always hate when comedies have to resort to misunderstandings to bring up laughs,
yeah.
And Bringing Up Baby is nothing but misunderstanding upon misunderstanding. That's like the key part of its plot.
Not even thought out misunderstanding. Just plain idiotic misunderstanding. I agree entirely. It is an awful film. And you know what? Since we've already somewhat praised Leni Riefenstahl, bring on the hate mail. We can take it.
Like, the only good part of the movie was the leopard. Besides Cary Grant.
I didn't even like the leopard. I didn't like the leopard because the leopard wasn't even recorded well. It was like, what was that?
I don't know, but it sounded a lot like Tony Curtis in
Spartacus.
In Spartacus.
You sounded like the guy trying to do the leopard cry in Bringing Up Baby.
Michael Wincott as the leopard would have been vastly more
roar.
Yeah.
I'm a leopard. Roar.
Might I have the pleasure of your intestines?
Dad, oh, give me these intestines on my fifth birthday.
I would pay to see the leopard go batshit and kill Catherine Medburn in this movie.
That's how it should have ended. All right, Steve. I think you're the last one in line here. What's your ugly for Howard Hawks?
Well, I really, really want to say A Song Is Born just because it's a musical and, you know, fuck musicals. But
oh, you know what?
But no, I also really wanted to say I Was a Male War Bride because the movie bored me to tears.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough.
It did. But no, you know what? Bringing Up Baby is just so ridiculously absurd. I gotta stick with Bringing Up Baby and just basically agree with everything you guys said. The movie is
just let this podcast peter out.
Yeah. I really have nothing to add. It's a shitty movie. And to be honest, I don't think Hawks should have done comedies. I really don't.
What? You didn't like Ball of Fire?
To be fair, I haven't seen Ball of Fire, but I've seen, you know, I've seen Bringing Up Baby, I've seen Monkey Business, I've seen I Was a Male War Bride, His Girl Friday, and it's just like, you know, none of them really raise the pulse at all.
Well, see Ball of Fire now, Steve.
Yeah.
I can't see it right now, I'm recording a podcast.
Well, dare I say, bringing up baby falls into the some like it hot category, which I also find completely unfunny, despite the baffling adoration it gets from seemingly every quarter.
Mm, that's because the lead actress is dead.
Oh, yeah.
She died tragically, so everybody has to love
her. And there's Tony Curtis dressed as a girl. That's funny, right?
Yeah. I would... George E. Brown, I would like
to wearing high heels
into a wood chipper.
No, I just, you know... Yeah, I just... Hawks in general, not a fan of his comedies. And bringing up Baby was pretty...
The worst.
At least, I watched from credits to from opening credits to the end with I Was a Male War Bride and didn't cringe so much as was just bored. But bringing up Baby, I was cringing a lot.
Oh, so much cringing.
I'm stiff from all the cringing.
My cheekbones will never recover.
Frozen in a grim rictus of non-humor.
Like, I can see the Joker torturing people with bringing up Baby, like, in the last cast.
This guy's been watching Brand X. All right, because I really don't want to end on this low point, I have a couple of movies I want to discuss really briefly.
Okay.
Because they narrowly missed going on my good. Only Angels Have Wings, I think, is a great example of the Hawks, you know, bringing his theme of professionalism and camaraderie and sort of that great tension you got in that sort of semi-comedic, you know, I guess it's something unique to the period of bringing a woman into a man's world and mm-hmm. the tension that caused. It's also got some beautiful photography, some great aerial photography, and some genuinely really touching dramatic scenes.
And that guy who plays McPherson is really good in it. I don't
know. Yeah, what's his name? Ordinarily, I would have his name right at the tip of my tongue, but it's failing me. Thomas something? Thomas Mitchell? Is that the guy?
Sure.
I'm thinking of a different character. I'm thinking of Kid Dabb. Thomas Mitchell's great in it. You're talking about Richard Barthelmess, I think. But anyway, regardless, it's a great movie with lots of great performances. I strongly urge everyone to go out and see it. And another one that we never really got around to discussing is To Have and Have Not, which is, of course, the very, very famous adaptation of Hemingway's novel, which sort of led to it's still sort of like considered the high point of the Bogart-Bacall pairing on screen in many ways. It certainly has the most iconic scene, but it's got Walter Brennan, so.
It does.
Be warned.
I'm whistling through my teeth.
What you do, you just put your lips together and blow. That would have been quite different.
I also want to say it's not one of his better known or recognized movies, but The Dawn Patrol is pretty boss too.
One I unfortunately didn't get around to seeing it for this one, so I haven't seen that one, but I desperately want to.
I was just looking up his filmography. I came across some blog where he had it ranked as his worst movie. I was like, you sir are a fucking idiot.
What, The Dawn Patrol?
The Dawn Patrol.
Really?
Yes.
And let me just say, The Outlaw, despite all of its, you know, controversy for Jane Russell's cleavage, really not that great.
No, it's not. I almost picked that as my
even with Walter Houston. But yeah, I guess now's probably a good time. We should probably maybe wrap up with some final thoughts. So, John, any final thoughts on Howard Hawks?
I wasn't actually a huge buff on Hawks coming into this podcast. You know, I went back, I watched a lot of movies that I didn't even know he had directed. And it, in a way, it was really, really interesting because a lot of our legendary directors nowadays, I know that this guy was one of their legends when they were younger.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
John Carpenter, notably.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
There you go. I mean, without Howard Hawks, we wouldn't have Assault on Precinct 13. And without Assault on Precinct 13, we wouldn't have the remake of Assault on Precinct 13.
But then the other way of looking at it is, without Howard Hawks, we wouldn't have Ghosts of Mars.
We wouldn't have that thing.
I'm sorry I went there. I apologize.
Please, you should go back and rewatch Ghosts of Mars.
I know it's not as bad as people say.
It's not particularly.
We'll get to Carpenter soon, guys. So hold up your horses.
All right, Gabe, any final thoughts from you, Gabe?
I'm not really well versed into classic American films. I must say that's the biggest area where I'm lacking knowledge. So I didn't really know Hawks at all, except from his reputation. And I found myself enjoying most of the movies I saw. Finding that he really had a left hand at tackling these different notes in the movies with the use of the suspense and the comedy and interesting characters. And he never really gets in the way either of the movie. Like, he's never like, oh, look, I'm doing this amazing shot, you know? He's never too artsy for his own good, you know?
He doesn't show off.
No, he doesn't show off at all. He just does what's good for the movie. And I feel he tackled most of his movies, like, in a serious manner and just tried to do the best with the material that he had. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at the original, The Thing from Another World, I mean, it's a pretty slight plot, you know?
Oh, very. Hardly anything really happens in it.
Yeah. But the way he films it is interesting, and the tension he manages to bring to it, and the camaraderie.
That he manages to bring tension out of a walking carrot is pretty
And out of a fungus. Something that I found funny is, like, I watch Only Angels and Wings and then The Thing, and in those two movies there are people named McPherson and Tex.
It's a good shorthand for the character. All right, Steve, how about you? Final thoughts?
He was one of the guys, like, he was one of those names that was kicked around when I did do a few courses and stuff, and, like, he was a name that kept popping up. And I've known who he was, and I've been familiar with a few of his movies, but I always kind of thought of Hawks as a genre filmmaker. Like, I've always thought of him as, like, an action filmmaker or a Western filmmaker or whatever. And then when I go back and I look at his body of work, I was actually pretty surprised by how much diversity was in there. You know, he had those, like, those romance adventures and just straight up romance flicks. And then, of course, the screwball comedies. And I mean, I'd always known Bringing Up Baby was there, but I used to kind of think of Bringing Up Baby as an anomaly, as you know, just something out of left field, but it wasn't. Like, he was kind of all over the map. But I do think that, you know, the Howard Hawks I'll always relate to, like, the Howard Hawks I'll always enjoy is the Howard Hawks who kind of goes in with John Huston, Billy Wilder, John Ford, like, those real genre filmmakers, you know, like, the noir, the Western, the action. That's where I gravitate with Hawks. And, I mean, that's probably more my own tastes than anything.
You know, it's funny you say that, because in a way, I mean, the variety of things he tackled is kind of covered by those guys, you know?
Yeah.
You've got the Ford Westerns. Obviously, he's not Ford. He's filmed in a very different way. But, you know, he does the same... I guess the tone of some of his Westerns can be slightly similar. Billy Wilder, you know, did zany comedies and noirs. And, you know, Walter Huston did these, you know, really sort of unforgiving dramas. And really those sort of, like, tough, manly characters. And Hawks sort of embodies all of that.
He does, yeah, he really does. And, I mean, he's, even on his peers, even guys like Wilder and Ford, and, like even with those guys, you can kind of see Hawks in them as well, you know? Like, you can, they all kind of interchanged, I guess. And, you know,
he was certainly a good friend of Ford's.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, and he worked with Wilder, obviously.
He did, yeah, yeah.
And And also, we've talked about it earlier, and even though, like, you never see his name in the script, you can feel that it's a Hawks film just from the dialogue.
Often.
He actually had a trick that he would do when he worked with his writers to make sure that it came out the way he wanted. He would tell his writers when they'd write the script, and then once they had the lines they wanted the characters to say, he'd say, write a bit before and write a bit after.
Yeah,
every line.
Context, yeah.
So you'd always get that overlapping, but what it meant was you'd always, the stuff that wasn't garbled, the stuff that wasn't talked over, was the important stuff. So you always got what you needed to get, but you still got that constant talking over, that realistic sense of people, like we, you know, like we're always stomping on each other's words, right? only in his case, you actually got the important stuff. Yeah, I guess for my final thoughts, I'll just say you guys have pretty much covered it. I mean, he was super versatile, and, you know, he had a distinctive way of making a movie, but it was also totally unobtrusive. He was all about telling the story in the best way he could. And, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, his reputation is still out there, and for good reason. So
I mean, to me, from that era, like from that whole golden age kind of thing, John Huston is still the man. But Hawks is definitely...
He's up there.
Yeah.
There aren't many better. All right, well, thanks for tuning in, guys. Have we decided who we're doing next week?
Oh, yes.
Yes, I have.
Oh.
I've been talking for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks about doing, like, either an anime director or Joel Schumacher. But... And this is just me being emo now. I kind of feel like I've been throwing out our cool-down directors in between stronger intellectual choices.
Hey, man, John Hughes was totally a cool-down director.
thank you for taking that this time around, Steve.
No sweat.
But I got something special for you guys next week. Ladies and gentlemen, hailing from Fresno, California... Standing at a 5.5 Coke line and weighing 750 milliliters of rye whiskey. The original Fresno Kid, the Baron of Bullets, the Emperor of Extreme Violence, the Lord Marshal of Hard Living, Bloody Sam Peckinpah.
I cannot wait.
Woo!
Awesome choice, John. All right, thanks everybody for tuning in, and we will hope you'll listen to us next week. Good night.
Good night.
Best next week. It's going to get messy.